Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is Menachem Lubinsky, the man who's a walking encyclopedia on the history of kashrus in America, the man who's an absolute authority on marketing kosher items in America. He's the founder and CEO of Lubicam Marketing. Good evening, Mr. Lubinsky.
Good evening.
Let me ask you a little bit about the state of kosher today, how far it's come in the last, let's say, 10 years.
The industry has grown tremendously over the last 10 years. Just to put it into perspective, the food industry as a whole has grown between 1 and 3% over that same period, while kosher has grown anywhere between 10 and 15%. Now, there are several reasons for that. One reason is that we have experienced a natural growth of people who eat kosher 365 days a year. There were recent studies that came out that showed that the Orthodox community grew by something close to 20%, or are now 20% of the overall Jewish population. In the past 10 years, kosher has become much more accessible. It is today in thousands of supermarkets, even in areas that were not known to be kosher areas. And the reason for that is that we have found that even Jews who don't participate much in any other part of the religion, when they do have a supermarket or a place that showcases kosher products, they tend to buy it. And especially on Passover, which is now 40% of the market. The other, if you're talking about the last 10 years, the other change has been the addition of the discount stores in a big way. The Costco's, the Walmart's, the Target's, the Trader Joe's, who were only nominally involved in kosher 10 years ago, are today very extensively involved in kosher. And that has made kosher even more accessible. And the third factor is that the independents, kosher stores, which had all but ceded their prominence over the years to the supermarkets, made a comeback and created stores, gourmet type of stores, which the kosher consumer had not seen before. All of this has contributed to the growth of kosher, or the kind of products that are now on the shelf also compete favorably with regular products, which is another reason why people who are not necessarily Jewish and not traditional kosher consumers buy the products. We've seen, for example, an explosion in gluten-free products that are kosher, and stores like Whole Foods and others showcase them, and people are buying them even as kosher products. So if you put all of these factors together and you ask what's changed, a lot has changed.
Considering the amount of kosher products that have appeared in the market in the last few years, it seems like to have a kosher certification has almost become a status symbol in this country. Is it the same thing in other parts of the world?
It is. It has not taken off as quite as fast as it is here in the United States, but there has been growth even in Europe and Asia and other parts of the world, certainly in the ingredient side. Because the ingredient side is a fascinating story unto itself. It's almost unlikely that you can produce an ingredient anywhere in the world and not make it kosher, because if your intent is to export to the United States, you won't be able to export to the United States unless it's kosher. Who's going to buy it? Coca-Cola won't buy it. Danone won't buy it. No large company or no small company will buy it. So by virtue of the fact that kosher has grown to what it is, we have seen, in effect, in the ingredient side, almost 80% of ingredients that go into products today have some form of kosher certification. The OU is in something like 92 countries. Ingredients is a story that most consumers don't necessarily recognize because they have the finished product. But it is part of that growth of kosher, and to some extent it has been driving the market more so for the kashrus industry, because kosher certification agencies have so many tens of thousands of ingredient items that they certify.
One of the interesting things, as I've been going to Kosher Fest over the years, is the explosion of exhibitors. And I am sure there are but a small percentage of the total amount of companies that actually do produce kosher. Care to tell us a little bit about the history of Kosher Fest, how it evolved, how you came up with it, and how it got to where it is today?
The idea of Kosher Fest began in the late 1980s, and this was about 2 years after a man by the name of Irving Silverman ran a kosher food and Jewish Life show in the Javits Center, and in Miami, and in Los Angeles, and in Chicago, and cities. And at that point, I had acquired the show and began to realize that the opportunity was ripe for a quality trade show that was focused on the kosher food industry. Up until that point, when you spoke about the kosher food industry, it wasn't much of an industry if you consider that you were trying to factor in Coca-Cola, which is a kosher company, and a mom-and-pop manufacturer, which is a small manufacturer. But through this show, which developed back in 1989, I think there were somewhat of 69 exhibitors and less than 600 visitors. And put it in perspective, today, this coming year, you're going to have close to 400 booths and well over 7,500 visitors. So the idea was that there has to be a place once a year where the industry gathers, where new kosher food products are showcased, where people meet, where trade buyers and exhibitors meet. And this has turned in now, we're in our almost 24 years since this process began. It's turned into an event that if you're in the food industry and you have any serious interest in kosher, that's the place to be.
What are some of the new products? If you cannot tell me specific companies, what are at least some of the products that are going to be appearing Kosher Fest this year that we have not seen before in the kosher market?
Well, I'm not sure that I have the final list, and usually that comes a little closer to the show. But my guess is that you'll see a lot more of gourmet items, in particularly in confectionery and chocolates and snack items. There's literally been an explosion on the gluten-free side, which, interestingly enough, has gone well beyond the people who suffer from celiac disease. We saw for the first time in the last year or two even matzah that was produced, even though you can't use it for the hamotzi, but it at least gave people what to eat on Pesach, who people who suffer. But it's part of the overall health and well-being consciousness that people have, that even if they don't necessarily suffer from particular diseases, if they want products that are good for you, that are particularly gluten-free, which is much better on the digestive system, we're going to see probably many line extensions. The line extensions have recently become sort of the modus operandi of the kosher food industry. So if I'm producing three items, chances are I'll produce two more. The number of new products for Pesach continues to grow. We just had a study by a very prominent research organization, Mintel, which studies each year studies new products and also studies the claims that are on the new products, that are on most of the new products. And again, they studied about 20,000 products. Most of the products had one feature that was common, that was the kosher. And It has almost become a question for people who are in manufacturing of food products. Why not? I mean, certainly the industry and the retail industry is ripe for it. They're looking for kosher. The marketing savvy people now say there's no reason to lose one customer because of a certification. And let's have the certification. In addition to which, as you aptly pointed out, the kosher certification is used as a marketing symbol of quality. It's a reassurance. We've seen in many, many studies that people who are not traditional kosher consumers look at kosher as just another way of measuring quality. I mean, if the USDA or the FDA says they can't possibly police all of the products that are being manufactured today, having a hashgacha means having another set of eyes. And there's also the perception amongst many, many non-Jews that kosher is healthier, not necessarily so in every product, but a good number of the products do have it because they don't use animal fat, and which has today become a no-no in every part of the healthy diet and healthy living. So this has kind of driven what the market is all about.
Last year, to prove the point about how important the kosher certification was, on my radio show you told a story about this pork rind sauce manufacturer that had an OU. Are there any other products that one would not think of as passively kosher that also care to have a kosher certification? Or was that an exception to the rule?
Well, it was an exception to the rule. I think that, you know, if you would have told me 20 years ago that there would be literally hundreds of sushi products that are kosher certified, I would say, you know, probably not with reality. There are things today that are coming on the market, and I think technology plays a very important part of that. Israel particularly is very advanced in food technology. They're able to develop products through technology. I'll give you a perfect example. I mean, no one was able to even mimic the taste of a crouton for Pesach that was based not on wheat, that was based on potato starch or whatever. And Olson developed it through technology, developed that process. So, you know, it puts the kashrus people on their toes, because today to be a mashgiach, it's not enough for you to know halacha. You have to be very savvy with technology. You have to understand that an ingredient may not be an ingredient, because an ingredient may be broken down into 10 other ingredients and have sub-ingredients, and they may have different names. So it's a whole new challenge and a whole new age. And yet, you know, I can't help but, you know, compliment the kashrus agencies for having kept up with it in an almost unbelievable way. Sure, you're here and there you'll hear something, but they're far and in between. I mean, and basically they're doing an incredible job in keeping track of products and ingredients, and that's to their credit.
So you're saying that the Rav Machshir not only has to know halacha, but he has to be basically a chemist and an engineer.
Well, even if he is not, he has to have access to someone who is able to do that. But today there are many, many Rabbanim who are trained in technology, but it's not only chemistry. It's understanding, for example, how the computer controls production. In areas where there's a time that is necessary to wash machinery in between productions, and the computer kind of regulates that and guides that, you have to understand exactly how the computer does that. So it's a whole new world. It's a world that, you know, I think we've pretty well come to expect that the kashrus officials will adjust to, and they have. And I guess the good news is this is only the beginning.
So what exactly drove the revolution, the explosion of kosher products? Let's face it, the traditional Haredi public never knew the other products. All of a sudden, you see many Hasidim, many Litvishe asking for the latest and the latest in gourmet items, which 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they never even heard of. What suddenly drove that? Where did that awareness come
from? Well, to some extent, the awareness came from an overall focus in general society that, even though they may not have been tuned into, has changed the way food is looked at. I mean, if you think about it, that there's a channel on television that deals with nothing else than food.
Right.
You know, it just shows
the
you. It shows you.
There's a couple of them.
A couple of them, food channels, and people are glued to the TV, and there are competitions and things like that. But in the more orthodox world, it became almost fashionable to try to take food to the next level. Today there are more cookbooks in a Sfarim store, in a Judaica store, than ever before. I think a young woman who gets married today wouldn't suffice for her just to know how to cook. She would have to be almost a gourmet chef. A presentation, and there are magazines that come out every week with new recipes, and there's a challenge. This has become a way of life. So the awareness came from the idea that food can be much more than what it is. I mean, there was a time where we joked and we said kosher food was chopped liver and stuffed cabbage and gefilte fish. Not that these were bad, but you can go to a wedding today and that could only be a very small part, or non-existent, not even there.
Usually,
you know, not even existent. But you know, what has been interesting is that some foods that were the traditional foods have made huge comebacks. The idea that cholent and kugel and herring are doing as well as they do, I mean, with no longer being necessarily a Shabbos business. And 20 years ago, these categories were almost dead, certainly in terms of retail. So there is somewhat of a melding of the old and the new, because even people are looking for the kind of the new cuisine, don't want to give up on the old guy, because that it's kind of like a link back to a grandma's house and to how they grew up. And even I find that with many, many secular Jews who walk into a supermarket and go into go to the deli counter, and the first thing they'll ask, do you have chopped liver, do you have stuffed cabbage, because they remember it very well from the homes that they grew up
in. You were mentioning some of the traditional foods. Yes, they are coming back, but quite often they are coming back slightly different, or sometimes very different, from the way we remember them as children. For example, there is a caterer whose name is Gad Chont, and all he does is different types of chont. 30 different types of chont, each one better than the next. Incredible, all of them. And let's face it, when we're growing up, we Ashkenazim, who ever heard of dafina? What was dafina? We didn't even know how to pronounce the word back. Today, in my shul, for example, on Shabbos, dafina is eat. Nobody wants to taste it, regular traditional chont. And the same thing with many other foods. For example, in the wine in the industry, there was a time when the joke was, oh, you want a kosher wine? No problem. Buy any bottle, throw out half of it, fill it up with sugar, mix it well, you now have kosher wine. When Levana's restaurant decided that they wanted to serve dry wine, conventional wisdom said, you guys are out of your mind. It'll never happen. Well, it did. And now that we are consuming dry wines and semi-dry wines much more than we are consuming a traditional sweet wine. So yes, our taste is growing. But is it because we are somehow exposed to the advertising of the secular world, or is it because of the Balei Tshuvas? Or is it because of the non-Jews who are buying kosher products? What is the driving force?
Well, the driving force is that we have a very young and dynamic generation today. We estimate that well over 60% of the kosher market in the traditional kosher market is below the age of 40. And there's a whole new mindset about how they look at food or how they look about life in general. I mean, as far as they're concerned, the operative term is that they would like to see anything that could possibly be kosher to become kosher. They want to experience the general culture in a kosher way. So that has driven one part of the industry. The industry itself has kind of motivated itself because, you know, when you mentioned 30 types of chont, what has been proven over and over again is that the new products drive profit. And so every company can be busy all year long looking and researching and developing products that they can bring on the market. And sometimes these products are, as I mentioned before, line extension, are just tweaked from an original product with a different flavor, sometimes a different smell, a different look, that makes it in a different category. So why should somebody sell one category of chont if he can sell 30? Especially if there's a market for it. But I think what has worked incredibly well for the kosher food industry is this young generation that's not afraid to try new things and wants to try new things. And they go to new restaurants and they try new menus. And this has been an incredible incentive for the kosher food industry to meet them. So it's kind of like it's a great match. The industry looking to expand, this is their expansion mode. A generation that's looking to expand its taste bud, and so it's worked very well.
Well, about expanding the taste buds, it's not only the young generation. When I was growing up, the only kind of wine that I knew in Uruguay was extra sweet. My father, Olav Asholom, used to make 400 bottles of wine a year. 3 weeks before Pesach, he would bottle them. It's 21% extra sweet. Today, if you were to give me a glass of that, I would keel over. Couldn't drink it. Then I didn't know any better. Neither did my father. I remember giving my father once Masti Spumante. He spit it out. He says, "Dos is wine." So I guess taste does change with the culture, with the years, so on, as civilization advances. Now, as our tastes change, also we like new challenges. For example, there is a book called Kosher Revolution by Gila Hakerman. And one of the first items in that book is prosciutto. Now, let's face it, prosciutto does not sound kosher. We all know it can't possibly be kosher. Her variation is she makes it from duck. And the people that she tasted and that she tested it on said that they could barely tell the difference. So obviously she must have figured something out. Same thing with other things. But if you had to predict where the industry is going, what would you say?
It's a very good question, but I want to step back for a moment and address the wine issue, because the wine issue has been almost a phenomenon unto itself. It does have some of the same characteristics as the gourmet food in terms of who the buyers are and all that, but kosher wine is a success story that you can almost attribute to one brand, And that's the Kerem company. I think because they did something that is so classical in marketing, but not used very often. They did not only sell the product, they became the educators of the product. And they educated an entire generation that kosher wine does not have to be the kiddish wine and the sweet wines, as you pointed out. It wasn't only that they educated, they made the presentation. They took the trouble to demo it, to put it out there, to put out the materials about wine, even in terms of pairing food and wine. They have an event every year mm-hmm. where they showcase wine, but the idea is it's good wine and good food. And they also managed to go to the winemakers all over the world who probably were in trepidation about kosher and made it easy for them. Brought in their expertise, brought in their hashgacha, brought in the wines to sell for them. So wineries in places that never even dreamt that they might be able to produce a kosher wine became kosher. So that leads to the question that you asked, where is the kosher food industry heading? You know, every time I think that it reaches a plateau, it continues to grow. There absolutely is no limit in the opportunities for kosher. What happens in the industry is sometimes that there's a realignment, which means that maybe in the 1950s, 60% or 70% of kosher food was sold in the independent stores, and maybe 20-30% in supermarkets. Today, that might be the reverse. Or it might be that the discount stores are taking a bigger chunk. We're in an era right now where supermarkets are not doing as well as they used to do, primarily because of the discount stores. So there's no saying that in 5 years from now, the primary sellers of kosher food will be the discount stores. If you want to go kosher, you're going to go to a Walmart or a Costco or a Trader Joe's. So the realignment. But each time there is also realignment, there's growth. There's significant growth. The challenge for the food industry is to supply that growth, to come out with the products that are of high quality, in demand. We found that if you can put out 500 new products on Pesach and you sell well with about 200, 250, that's an incredible ratio, and that's happened in the last couple of years. So we're headed up. There's no question where we're headed with it.
It's interesting what you said about the discounters. For example, I travel to Richmond, Virginia a lot. I have relatives there. And when I go to a supermarket like Kroger's or Martin's or Food Lion, selection of kosher is very, very small. On the other hand, if I go to Whole Foods or I go to Trader Joe, there's a tremendous selection. And that's in an area that the kosher consumer is not a big percentage. Now, let me ask you one question. Let's face it. If the kosher industry would depend strictly on the Jewish consumer, most of them would have disappeared a long time ago. Obviously, there are other ethnic groups who buy kosher. What would you estimate are the percentages of the various groups who buy kosher?
That's an excellent question. I think the dynamics here are as follows. The wheel starts to grind when a traditional kosher consumer wants a product. Marketing savvy supermarket people will satisfy a very small market, even if it is a small market, because their objective is to keep that consumer in the store to buy as much as possible. Now, what happens is that once that product is now accessible to everyone, there are more people that are outside of the traditional market that pick up that product. So all of a sudden, a product that might have had, let's say, 100 people pick it up is now 300 people, 400 people. Now, why do people pick up these products? They pick up because they think it's healthier, they like it. For example, I've seen in places where there are very, very few Jews, but they have kosher pickles with hashgacha, and they sell extremely well. Of course, we're now into an age where we have success stories of ethnic products that have become mainstream. I mean, it used to be that the classical example for that was the bagel. Because the bagel is probably the only product that I know of that retained its Yiddish name for round and is sold in Osaka as a bagel as it is in Brooklyn. But you have categories today like, for example, hummus, which PepsiCo took over for acquired a good part of Sabra, and hummus has become a mainstream item. And today, I don't know what the numbers were, but it went from somewhere like a $40 million business to a $300 million business. The same is happening to horseradish, and to some extent. So, and this has become a challenge for the industry. So, the short answer to your question is that the Jews are the engine. The Jews and the people who eat kosher are the engine that drives the market. But it is the beginning of a process. It's the beginning of a process that makes this whole dynamics much, much larger. And so, whether this was done so on purpose by the good Rabbeinu Shalom, that he wanted Jews to be able to eat well, so he had to create a much larger frame for it. I don't want to get into the spiritual cheshbonos, but whatever it is, the dynamics of it are such that the market is much, much larger than it should have been if it were just for people who eat kosher 365 days a year.
In numbers, how did the kosher industry develop over the years? How big is it today, kosher production around the world, or at least in the United States?
Well, I can give you some numbers. In Israel, it's today about a $16 billion market. The studies show that about 70% of Israelis eat kosher. Somewhat over 60% keep a kosher home, even if they don't observe much of anything else. The market in the U.S. has been pretty much about a $12.5 billion market. There are about 340,000 ingredient items that are certified today, about 165 or 175,000 consumer goods that are certified. I could see very well, by 2015, I could see the market being at somewhere about 14 to 16 billion here in the United States. So, and to put it into perspective, when we looked at this back in the late 80s, the total kosher market was somewhere between 1.5 and 1.6 billion for the entire United States. Yeah, dramatic things have happened with kosher.
And we're just about out of time. Thank you very much, Mr. Levinsky. As always, it's fascinating speaking to you. It's always a pleasure speaking to you. Very informative. Thank you very much. Thank you, one and all, ladies and gentlemen. Good night, and tune us in again next Wednesday at blacktalkradio.com/kosher scene. Thank you very much, and good night, one and all.